Okay, thank you very much again for coming. This is our second part of the Fundamentals of Operation course. This workshop is predominantly for all individuals with responsibilities for retirement program, especially with those that have a fiduciary responsibility to the plan. It's designed to provide a basic understanding of the operations of defined benefit as well as defined contribution plans, supplemental and primary plans. And if you recall from the first webinar, the entire course that you also have the reading materials for, there are 7 chapters. The first webinar covered plan administration and the role of an administrator. The remaining chapters will be covered over this webinar and then the last part of this course in December. So today we're going to talk about contracting service providers and administering distributions. And then in December we'll finish it up with a discussion of plan amendments, special events within a retirement plan, as well as non-qualified deferred compensation plans and the operations for that type of a program, as well as the monitoring and evaluation that's needed in all the various types of retirement plans. Again, today we're going to cover chapters 3 and 4, contracting service providers and administering distributions. So let's get started with the discussion on contracting service providers and how do you know what the difference between outsourcing and keeping the program functions, the operations in-house, and the process to go about selecting those contract providers. So what is outsourcing? Outsourcing is defined as the transferring work that would normally perhaps be done in-house, but it's the transferring work to an outside source that you actually go in contract with for that service. Generally, particularly in the public sector, a competitive bidding process is going to be used to select those contract providers. You might handle the entire process, the contracting process may be handled in-house, or you may actually outsource that as well to a consulting firm or someone else to help you with that selection process for outsourcing services. The public sector generally is going to outsource most of the administration, the operations of supplemental defined contribution plans, but generally within the public sector, the primary defined benefit plans are handled by state agencies, state employees, or the local governments directly, instead of outsourcing the services and operations for those plans. So how do you decide what is going to be outsourced? What's the process that's involved in determining what is outsourced is a fiduciary function in generally all these plans. The types of services that might be, the type of functions that might be outsourced includes the administration, any of the investment products that are used for the program, the investment providers, as well as participant services, consulting services, educational services. Those type of functions might also be outsourced. When you're looking at how you decide what should be outsourced, you're going to conduct some type of initial analysis to determine, can it be handled more efficiently by somebody else than handled in-house? Is it through economies of scale? Perhaps it's a smaller employer. You're not going to have the resources available in order to handle the in-house, all of the services or functions for that program in-house, and it may be more cost-effective and efficient to be done by an outside provider. Also, is there something that can be improved upon, or is it something that can be handled more with greater benefit to participants through an outsourced provider? So those are just some of the questions that need to be answered in any analysis to determine what functions, what operations, what part of the program will be outsourced instead of retaining that function with the employer staff themselves. If you do determine that outsourcing is desired and it's something that is needed, you're going to want to first and pretty much one of the most critical steps is to establish a timeline. When do you want that service to begin and have it to be with sufficient time to handle any potential problems or issues that come up so that you have some contingencies figured into that timeline? And it needs to be reasonable for all parties involved. When you're looking at an actual implementation date, there's always going to be something that is unexpected that comes up, so you need to make sure that that timeline is flexible. You may need to push something back. Rarely are you going to find in an outsourced environment the ability to move that schedule up. But in particularly in when you're looking at outsourcing or changing providers from one to another within a defined contribution plan, there are specific requirements for plans under ERISA. And if you can recall from our previous courses, public sector retirement plans are not subject to the federal law that's called ERISA. And I'm not going to get into that again today, but private sector employers must follow specific rules and requirements under the Department of Labor and under ERISA for any blackout periods that are and put into effect because of a transition. Generally, public sector plans are going to follow those same rules and guidelines as best practice, but what basically it means is you need to give participants sufficient time when they're making decisions on their investments. If you need to put in blackout period into effect where there is no transactions being handled or being implemented or initiated during a specific period of a blackout, that you need to give enough forewarning to participants so they can make sure that any actions that they want to take on their accounts can be handled prior to that blackout. So communication during any type of blackout period is key. When you're looking at outsourcing, cost is another critical factor in your decisions as to what will be outsourced versus what's going to be handled with in-house staff. And who you're going to ultimately select for that outsourced services if you determine to go that route. A cost-benefit analysis can help you identify what is the best for the plan and its participants, meaning perhaps something is going to cost a little bit more, but the services or products are going to be of better value. They're going to be enhanced for participants. Their participant will get a better experience and that makes the additional cost worthwhile. Additionally, maybe the cost-benefit analysis will show you that you can actually reduce costs without eliminating some of the value that's available to the value that's already being provided to participants. Again, through economies of scale, if you're doing if you're doing education in-house. If you go and outsource that, you might be able to get a better value and actually reduce costs. So that's one way where you may find that outsourcing is a better value to participants and you can actually reduce the costs associated with that service. When you're looking at how to select an outsourced provider, generally within the public sector there is a very formalized procurement process that is sometimes cut in stone. You know, there's not a lot of flexibility in regard to how your procurement process must be handled. There's a request for proposal that is often, if not almost universally used within the public sector as well as the private sector, that's going to provide the basis for any decisions on the contractors that will be selected and contracted with for the retirement plan. The request for proposal process, it offers one of the advantages for that is it provides a consistent basis for you to gather information from those potential contractors. And it provides a method for you to actually easily compare apples to apples, the services and the costs associated with those services that you're seeking. Most importantly, when you're looking at a retirement plan and the reason for doing a competitive bidding process through a request for proposal, it provides substantial documentation for fiduciaries that you have conducted a very thorough and appropriate due diligence process and you have met your fiduciary needs to the fiduciary responsibility to the plan, and that can be demonstrated through your request for proposal process, meaning that you're not selecting a provider simply because, gosh, I know that person, or it's a relative, or there's no conflict of interest is what really the request for proposal process demonstrates. In addition to the request for proposal, another approach that could be used and should be considered in some circumstances is a condensed version called a request for information. There's various and assorted reasons why you may use that request for information instead of a request for proposal, but generally it is going to provide a little bit more flexibility in regard to the services that you're seeking. You're going to solicit, maybe you don't know exactly what it is that's out there and made available in regard to that type of service you're seeking, and by asking a request for information, you can get more information, you can solicit more information from providers, from those entities that may be interested in providing those services to the plan in a broader approach, meaning you can maybe offer questions in an RFI that are more open-ended in nature so that they can offer you something that you didn't even know you needed or wanted. The reason for an RFI, you may use an RFI to narrow the field of providers, that instead of having 20 people bid on, through a request for proposal, you're going to narrow that field down to maybe 5 by seeking a request for information and then being able to tailor your request for proposal more in a finite method. An additional use for RFI is when the functions that you're going to outsource are minimal. You don't have a lot of issues that you're dealing with. It's a very small or finite approach to a services that you're you're trying to seek through an RFI. It also may help you develop a more in-depth RFP document. And again, that can actually lead you to be able to narrow the field of providers. In some situations, request for information is just that. All you're doing is seeking a request for information. There's not going to be an actual contracting result from an RFI. That's not absolute, however. There's some types of request for information that you can actually say at the end of those, you could contract directly with someone as a result of that RFI. So it can lead to contracting, but in general it won't. But it doesn't prohibit you from contracting with somebody through a request for information approach. When you're looking at the request for proposal and putting that document together or RFI, the objectives of the plan need to be the foundation of your outsourcing project, meaning you need to clearly identify what those objectives are for that outsourcing project so the potential bidders are able to identify, one, do they want to bid on it, two, do they have the right, is that the right party for the job, and know exactly what you're trying to accomplish through that RFP or RFI. When you're putting that document together, you need to make sure that all parties that are going to be involved with that contractor have the ability to provide input. So you need input from all the parties that are part of the project, and they need to be considered in the RFP and RFI as well as the objectives of that project. You also need to examine what the industry holds, what type of providers are out there and what are they providing already that may be of interest to you so that you can include that in the RFP. You also want to establish a tentative timeline right at the beginning of the project for the RFP process, the development of it, as well as when it will be released and what your time frame is for implementation of whatever services that you're seeking. The next step in the RFP or the competitive process is to identify who your audience is. Who is it that may be available to or who may be interested in providing a bid on your services and who's out there? You know, is there one company or is there 20 company? That can have a huge difference in how you develop your RFP and how open-ended you want it. The different ways that you can identify your potential bidders is to just go and look at the current contracts that are used by the employer, your peers within the industry, if you're a part of a national organization such as the National Association of Government Defined Contribution Administrators or National State Retirement Administrators or GFOA. There's a lot of different national organizations that you can actually pull from to see the types of contractors that are out there that are interested in your type of project and the services that you're seeking. Once you develop a list, you can also go to trade publications. There's all various and assorted different, like Plan Sponsor and some others that are out there that you can go to and look at the trade publications to see what vendors there are and the services that they are offering. While you're working on your request for proposal and the development of that document, you want to then put together a list of these potential bidders and then even send a letter to them telling them that you are in the development stage for a request for proposal and would they be interested in bidding. This is another way to help you narrow down that field right away to determine or to see if you need to expand the field somehow if you don't get sufficient interest in your project. But you can send a solicitation letter to these individual companies or providers to start working on a final list for potential bidders. This doesn't mean that you wouldn't also put a notice in a publication or do some other outreach to provide a open process for bidding, but you're doing some due diligence at the front end just to identify who is out there that might be interested in your project. The last thing you want to do is go through an entire RFP and get it all sent out and it's 150 pages long and have nobody bid. So it's important that you do take a little bit of effort at the front end to make sure that there are interested parties out there for your project. So when you're developing the RFP document, the competitive bidding document itself, you need to provide a detailed definition of all the services or the products that the employer is seeking through this outsourcing effort. Any information about the plan and its participants that is relevant to the bid itself, to their response to your RFP, needs to be provided. It needs to be detailed and as thorough and as complete and accurate as possible. If you are seeking changes to the current plan or any enhancements to your current plan that you are trying to accomplish through the RFP, they need to be clearly and specifically spelled out in that document so that they know that they're not just bidding on the current program as is, but you're also looking for some improvements. You can also leave it open-ended in an RFP document. What else can you provide us? I mean, you want to make sure that you're getting the best products or services that are out there, so you don't want to cap it. You don't want to leave it where if somebody has something better to offer, you're not giving them a chance to provide it to you in the competitive process as well. One thing that is critically important for the reviewers when you come back and you need to analyze and score these documents is that everybody is providing their proposals in a consistent format so that you are able to really look at each item that they're providing and compare them easily. So you need to spell out specific formats that they have to follow when submitting the proposals. And in any special instructions that you have in regard to their proposed cost. Generally, you're not going to have them submit the nuts and bolts of the proposal, meaning the specific information about how, what, where, when, why of the document of the RFP itself and the cost together. Cost is going to be separately submitted, and you're not going to open that at the same time. You're going to evaluate how they're going to do the program, the services that they're going to provide, or the investments or products that they're going to provide. And then once you've scored and they've reviewed all that, then you will open the cost and then you won't be influenced by your scoring on the types of products and services based on the cost of the what they're proposing as cost. So you're going to keep those separate, and you're going to provide special instructions or separate instructions for how they submit the cost in the competitive process. Once the request for proposal is distributed, or before you actually distribute it, you're going to want somebody else. If you're writing it in-house, or if you're having a consultant write your RFP itself, you're going to want somebody to specifically go through that document and edit it for clarity and thoroughness. Do they understand everything that's being said in there? Is there anything that's left out? If you are the one that is 100% responsible for the program, you may be too involved in it to know that what you're saying isn't clear to the outsider. Keep in mind that those providers that are bidding on the program may have no experience whatsoever with your program, and you need to make sure that you're providing specific and clear information that you want them to respond to. Often, the request for proposal, particularly today, is distributed electronically or it's posted to the employer website with instructions for submission. So you're not necessarily creating, like I did 20 years ago, tons and tons of paper, killing many, many trees to send out these RFP documents and then getting back all of this documentation again with multiple pages. Sometimes you also are allowing the vendor to submit electronic versions of their proposal as well. But that's up to the vendor, to the employer, to determine how those are going to be distributed and the types of responses that you're going to want to receive. In addition to, once the RFP has been distributed and sent out and you give the potential bidders sufficient time to review it, there are going to be questions that come up. And as a result of those questions, generally an employer will have what's called a bidders conference. You have the right as the entity that's issuing this RFP to demand or to require anybody that's going to submit a bid to attend, whether that's in person or perhaps even by phone, or if it's just leave it as an option. You can attend or not. You know, it's up to you. A lot of employers will require vendors to actually be to attend the bidders conference in person. It depends on the employer's perspective as to the need for that or not. But the questions are generally submitted to the employer, the person that is soliciting these bids, ahead of time. They must be in writing, or generally are in writing, whether it's electronic or paper, and that gives the entity releasing the RFP time to review the questions and answer them. And then the questions are answered at the bidders conference. If there are additional questions that come up at the bidders conference, those may be also answered at that time, or they may be answered later in writing. And then whatever is provided to one vendor, one potential bidder, must be provided to all. So at the point in time the questions are actually answered in writing, whether it's the entity that asked the question or not, you're going to submit those answers to all of the potential bidders that have indicated their desire to participate in that effort. Once you have submitted the RFP, and actually as you're writing the RFP, you're going to want to have specific information being developed at the same time as being written as to how this proposal is going to be evaluated. What are you looking for, and who's going to do the evaluation? So you're going to identify the evaluation team, whether it's one or more, many people that may be involved. Generally there will be a team of individuals responsible for evaluating the submitted proposals, and that criteria for evaluating those proposals is going to be developed at the same time as the proposal is being written. You're going to have some minimum requirements and some mandatory requirements. So minimum is that you must have, as an example, a large state employer that's seeking administrator for their supplemental retirement plan. And a minimum requirement might be that the entities that are providing, that are submitting a proposal, must have at least five years minimum experience with a similar sized employer in the public sector. And if it's a product provider, it could have a minimum assets under management. You know, so there may be some specific minimums that you're not going to even look at proposals that don't meet that minimum. You may also have some mandatory requirements, meaning that you might have some specifically in your plan design or your requirement that perhaps you're looking for a company that's located locally. I mean, that may be a mandatory requirement, and you're not going to consider anybody that is not part of that locality when you're seeking that service. Anything that is minimum or mandatory has to be specifically spelled out. And you'd also want to say, if you don't meet that, we're not going to review, we're not going to evaluate the rest of your proposal. That's one way to screen, so you don't have 25 proposals to look at and submit that, and 12 of them, there's no way that they would ever meet your needs. So you can set these minimum and mandatory requirements to help you screen out who would not be qualified for your project or your services that you're seeking. The evaluation criteria that you're going to then identify beyond the minimum and mandatory requirements, you're going to have specific categories. You're going to have so much of the score for the proposal is going to be assigned to cost, so much expertise and experience, and the last portion based on the quality of the services or the product. You're going to identify when you're doing your proposal writing how much of the actual total score is assigned to cost. Maybe it's 30, 35, and 35. 30% of the total is cost, 35% is experience, and 35% of the total is the quality of the service and our products. It's up to you to decide at the time you're writing the proposal and seeking the services what is the most important for your plan and its participants. And you're going to make that determination based on the best interest of the participants in the plan as you're writing the proposal. Again, generally you're not going to consider the actual cost into the total score until after you've evaluated and scored the rest of the proposal. That's so that you aren't influenced by the low-cost proposal who may not be the best for the plan and its participants. Once you've actually reviewed and evaluated the scores, and this could be before or after the cost. Not everybody does it the same way. Some people select finalists just based on the RFP score that does not include cost. There is no right or wrong approach. It's just based on and what the entity has determined is in the best interest of the plan. Also, it may be identified in their state procurement laws or the local government's procurement laws in regard to how these competitive processes will be handled. But generally, once you have identified and completed the evaluation, you are going to pick the top two or perhaps four proposals that are going to be considered the finalists. You may conduct on-site visits at this time, or you may bring them in. You may want to conduct more thorough examinations of them by asking additional questions or having them provide you with a presentation in person. Generally, those top 2 to 4 proposals are also going to be further reviewed through their reference checks. Some, depending on the size or scope of the project, reference checks can be handled by phone, but also evaluation teams may choose to conduct their reference checks in person, meaning go directly to those people that are provided as references and evaluate projects that they've conducted for them directly. So that there's various and assorted ways to conduct reference checks, but you want to identify what are the issues that you're most concerned about that maybe has raised some red flags during the proposal, or you'd like to see better how the vendors have handled situations, and you can maybe do that better in person than you can over the phone. After you have gone through the process to select your top finalists, you may give them one final chance to review their proposal and cost and provide you with the best and final offer. Often this is a good step to take because before you've actually started the contracting process, you may have some leverage to negotiate some better terms or conditions, something that maybe one vendor's provided in their proposal and another hasn't, but you really would prefer it. You want that product or that service in this one proposal, but you prefer a different vendor. And maybe say, okay, can you do this, and how much would it cost? And that this is the time to do it. Then you're also going to evaluate costs in an apples-to-apples comparison based on, okay, this vendor is the top in the products and services. Their cost, though, however, is not the lowest. Is it worth it or not? This is a very critical step in the process, which is to evaluate cost compared to value. And this step is another critical process to maintain documentation. Once, if you've negotiated best and final offers, whether you've gotten a different price or you've gotten some additional services or products, you want to make sure that that is completely documented in writing and all parties have signed off on that, so that you can incorporate that into the actual contracting. Okay, after you've gone through that step, the next is to actually decide who you're going to award the contract to. Often the evaluation committee at this point makes a recommendation or of their findings to the actual decision makers. It's generally the decision makers are not part of that team. There may be some there in that team, but the decision makers may be the board, it may be a department head, but you're going to have the evaluation team prepare documentation to make a recommendation and justify why that recommendation is going to be made. There also may be an opportunity for those, maybe the finalists or the top two that are part of the recommendation, to make a finalist presentation to those decision makers. That may or may not be part of the process, but it is a step that could be incorporated. Again, any decisions for contracting absolutely have to be made under fiduciary standards, meaning that it can only be based on the best interest of the participants and the beneficiaries of the plan. Generally, you're going to have contract negotiations begin immediately after the decision has been made to award the contract. Contracting can take a long time, so if the implementation date is soon, if you have an implementation date that it's going to occur before the contract can be finalized, often you will have a letter of agreement that is kind of like an interim step. We agree with everything in principle, and the contract itself incorporates the bid that has been submitted for, as a result of the RFP, all of the RFP documents, the Q&As from the bidders conference, and any follow-up questions that may have been raised, anything that is part of the on-site visits, all of those documentations are going to be part of the contract and can be incorporated into the letter of agreement. And then at the final, when you actually get down to officially signing contracts, they're all incorporated into the contract as well. So the contract itself can be multiple documents, and the negotiation process can be very lengthy. One thing that's important to include in any contract at the beginning is performance guarantees. If you have a timeline for implementation, or you have specific issues as to when things are going to be, what the performance is going to be, you're going to incorporate absolutes in regard to performance guarantees and any penalties for failure to meet those standards. So if you have a timeline established for implementation, for example, and you have perhaps it could be no later than kind of a date in there, and they don't meet that date, then you can put in some costs associated with failure to implement on time and penalize them through cost reductions or just a flat fee that's going to be assessed against their contract. So you want to incorporate that into the actual contract, and perhaps even into that earlier letter of agreement document before the contract is finalized. Okay, so when you're looking at, and I kind of already talked a lot about this slide, but the initial timeline needs to be a little bit flexible so that it can incorporate any contingencies that are contingencies that occur or any problems that occur, but the initial timeline needs to be based on both the plan needs as well as the provider needs, and specific steps along the way need to be identified with dates, and the responsible party for each step needs to be identified as well. So the timetable that is actually incorporated into the contract needs to be very specific and very detailed to ensure that there's nothing missed And all parties that are responsible for the various steps are aware of what their responsibilities are. I already talked about the letter of agreement, where it's something that is routinely used when a contract is not immediately executed. And as I mentioned, with all the documentation that's part of the process itself, including the best and final offers, they're going to be incorporated into that letter of agreement as well as the final contract. When you're looking at the implementation of the program, where the product or the services that are being, it's the steps along the way are going to be based on how complicated the project is, the outsourcing services are that you're seeking. If it's an investment product, may not be as complicated as it would be if you're seeking somebody to do administration. If it's a software that you're looking to do the record keeping for your system itself, that may be the most complicated of any. So the type of project that you're seeking is going to have a tremendous impact on the implementation process itself. But in general, you are going to want to make sure that you have a continuing and open dialogue between that provider and the employer's staff who are critical to the operations or the function that's being sought. So you're going to want to develop some sort of ongoing meeting, whether it's in person or phone, and you're going to want to have specific individuals identified to make sure that you are monitoring the timeline and the steps that have been identified, and you're going to want to have that monitoring process handled through frequent reports on status, and as well as the ongoing meetings that you have. We talked about performance standards being incorporated into the contract, and that those performance standards need to start being monitored immediately. And that's part of your implementation plan. When you're looking at the types of performance guarantees that you're going to incorporate into your contract and into the implementation process itself, you are generally going to have both qualitative and quantitative measurements, meaning the qualitative is not just, the quantitative is dates and times and how much is done and by whenever, and qualitative is how good a job is done. You know, did they do it accurately? Did they do it within the needs of the plan? And you might have some performance guarantees associated with quality as well as quantity. One of the things that it's critically important to identify, generally you're going to incorporate this into the RFP as well as the contracts, you're going to have specific steps or requirements on termination of any contract that you're negotiating or any contract that you're seeking to enter into. So you're going to have a termination clause as well as an exit strategy that is going to be incorporated into your contract negotiations. And the type of termination, the types of things that you're going to want to include is you're going to have a specific contract end date. You're going to have another clause that perhaps says the ability to extend contract end date that for a certain amount of time. That type of what's going to be involved with potential extensions would be incorporated into the contract. You're also going to identify the different ways that the contract itself might end. In addition to a specific contract end date, you're going to have the ability to terminate a contractor for cause, failure to meet the needs of the plan, failure to meet the requirements of the contract, some potential violations with laws. You're going to have a specific clause in the contract that allows you to terminate that arrangement for cause. Type of termination clause that might be in the contract is termination for convenience, and that could be potential that's not necessarily for cause, but there's other reasons that you might identify or outline that would be part of this termination for convenience clause. When you're looking at the actual contract, and the contract management that's involved with outsourced services, you're going to have someone that is identified through the employer, through the sponsor of that plan, as the the contract administrator. The plan administrator is going to be intricately involved in the contract development, but that administrator may have someone assigned as the contract manager. So there's multiple people that will be involved. It's critical that all parties involved in the process understand the terms of the agreement and agree with them. So it's the communications is key in the development of contracts. Again, performance guarantees and penalties are critical, and specific standards on performance must be spelled out in detail in order to accurately and appropriately monitor the performances and the ability to then assess any fees or penalties that might be assigned. In addition, you're going to have a specific way that you're going to monitor performances, whether that's going to be handled on an annual basis or quarterly basis, with abilities to say, okay, if you fail to meet your performance guarantees in one quarter, the next quarter we'll review it, but if you still fail to meet those performance guarantees, we're going to assess you double penalties. I mean, there's ways that you can put into that contract as to how you're going to monitor and measure performance guarantees, the frequency and the process, but all of that needs to be spelled out clearly and succinctly in the contract itself, so you don't run into any problems down the road when you try to hold outsourced the contractor's feet to the fire in regard to meeting the contract requirements. So once the contract has been signed, that does not end the responsibility of the employer or the contractor. You don't just say go off on your own and do it. You need to have an open and continuing relationship between the employer and the provider. The communication needs to be ongoing, and that's important so that you can both be comfortable with the parties involved, meaning that you trust that they're doing your job and you believe that they're competent. So the trust and competence is part of that communication process. If you don't have an open lines of communication, the other two won't be met. Monitoring is something that must be done on the plan level, and it's one of the most important roles that the plan administrator has to make in meeting fiduciary responsibilities to the plan and its participants. You've delegated certain responsibilities, you've through your outsourcing arrangements, but it's up to the plan sponsor, it's up to the employer and the parties involved, whether it be an administrator or a governing board or a committee that has ultimate responsibility for the plan. The only way that they can meet their fiduciary responsibilities to the plan is to monitor those outsourced contracts. And it is critical that you ensure that the vendor is providing accurate and timely information for you to be able to monitor that process. Often that's handled through audits, whether they be, and we talked about this in the first course that we did on the plan, but we'll get into it more in the fourth course on compliance and monitoring. But it's critical to do complete audits as appropriate as part of the steps in monitoring contractors. Okay, so now we'll go on to administering distributions. And distributions are not the same for each plan, similarities, but there are also some differences based on the type of plan that is being made available, whether it's a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan. Generally, however, distributable events are the same regardless of the type of plan. Separation of service, which is normal, or early retirement, termination, or resignation. That's a point in time when it is considered a distributable event. Death, disability, or to others, as to when the actual distribution might occur. In a defined contribution plan, you're also going to have the potential for loans or hardships or financial emergency withdrawals. those loans and hardship withdrawals are something that the plan must identify as a feature that they want incorporated into their plan. It isn't an absolute. So if the plan has not incorporated those distributable events into the plan document, they're not part of the plan. But all plans are going to be required to allow distributions at separation of service, death, and disability. Okay, as I mentioned, the rules vary by the different type of plan that is being offered. Defined benefit plans, if you recall, they generally provide lifetime benefit payments. They're a guaranteed benefit to employees based on service and earnings. Defined contribution plans, which are individual account plans where participants have their account balance based on the assets, the value of their accounts, and they generally have several different types of distribution options, ranging from lump sums, which is a full or partial distribution of their account balance, and or lifetime annuities, periodic payments. Are generally going to be part of a defined contribution plan as well. But in a defined benefit plan, generally the only type of form of distribution that you're going to have available are annuity distributions, unless the account value is so small that it's not worth the lifetime benefit, in which case some employers will, if the benefit amount is less than X amount, they will allow lump sum distributions. But generally, defined benefit plans are lifetime distributions, annuity-type distributions. Also in a defined benefit plan, plans are required under ERISA, and generally you're going to find the same type of laws in state statutes as well that requires participants of a defined benefit plan who are married to ensure that their spouse is covered under that plan distribution as well. So there's qualified pre-retirement survivor annuities, qualified joint and survivor annuities are for participants of a defined benefit plan that are married, that have a legal spouse. And the options that are paid to them the spouse itself has a right to receive to these distribution choices. If they don't want them, they must sign a waiver that they are okay with the participant being paid out in a different manner. But a qualified pre-retirement survivor annuity is the benefits paid to the surviving spouse if a married participant with a vested benefit dies before the benefit begins. So that's a benefit that is guaranteed to the surviving spouse should the participant die before they actually start receiving benefits. The qualified joint and survivor annuity is a benefit that is paid in a series of equal or periodic payments over the participant's lifetime, with payments at death continuing to the surviving spouse. There's different forms of this option, whether it's paid out 100% to the spouse at the death of the participant, 75% or 50%. There's different choices that can be made by the participant and the spouse, but the spouse has the right to not agree to that, and then the distribution must be handled in a form that is agreeable to the spouse as well as the participant through that waiver that I mentioned earlier. Within a defined benefit plan in particular, there is a need to identify normal retirement age. Normal retirement age is the age a participant can receive a benefit from that defined benefit plan without an actuarial reduction. In other words, when the full value of that benefit has been reached and the participant will receive that full value at normal retirement age. The Internal Revenue Service has identified through regulation specific rules for what the plan can identify as the earliest normal retirement age. In most circumstances, below age 55 is presumed to be unreasonable unless it can be justified by the facts and circumstances of that plan, meaning that the participants universally retire prior to age 55. Example for that is the qualified public safety, police and fire. Generally, their normal retirement age is much earlier than age 55. Between 55, but again, under federal tax laws, this is for public and private sector plans, and so they have identified, in general, below age 55 is presumed unreasonable. Between 55 and 62 is deemed reasonable if the employer makes a good faith determination, meaning that it's up to the employer to decide if between age 55 and 62, at some age in between there, is reasonable for the population that is covered by that plan. They don't have to go an additional step to justify by facts and circumstances to the Internal Revenue Service to the reason why they want a lower age. In the public sector, there are some exceptions. In the public sector, you can cover qualified public safety employees under a normal retirement age that is age 50 or that is as low as age 50, and that is presumed to comply with the federal tax laws. So there's some specific rules and requirements in regard to public sector normal retirement age that allows that age to be lower than age 55. The textbook itself covers some specific information about how to determine that, as well as the Internal Revenue Service website. There's a lot of information out there, and you can go directly to the regulation that identifies the determination of normal retirement age. So normal retirement distributions that can occur from qualified plans as well as individual retirement accounts, generally there's four. There's periodic payments, which are new annuities, and those are generally over the lifetime of the participant or beneficiary, participant and joint beneficiary. Discretionary installment payments, basically in defined contribution plans, we allow participants to take out money from their account periodically until their account balance is zero. So this year I want $1,000, next year I want $5,000. I mean, that's what a discretionary installment payment is, or actually that's an irregular distribution. I'm sorry, discretionary installment payments are, I want to distribute my account balance over the next 20 years in equal payments, and then that's just identified what those equal payments are, or I want my supplemental account to be paid out over the next in $500 monthly installment payments, and that's discretionary installment payments, and it's just going to be paid out until the account balance is zero or until they change that distribution. Irregular distributions is just what I mentioned earlier, which I misspoke, is that I'm just going to pick and choose how much I want to take out of my account at various times throughout until my account balance is zero. And then finally, the lump sum distribution is just I want that my entire account balance paid out to me in a single sum. And those types of distributions generally are not, the last three of this at least, are not part of a defined benefit a plan. That's a defined contribution of the supplemental plans that are made available. Regardless of the type of plan or type of distribution, all participants must be provided between 30 and 90 days prior to the receipt of that distribution what their rights are in regard to roll over those pre-tax distributions to avoid immediate taxation on them. The notice includes the federal tax obligations, meaning that they are subject to tax on the pre-tax dollars that have accrued in their account, and they also have to be provided in that notice the right to roll over those assets into another tax-favored plan, such as an IRA or another employer plan, and that notice, the Internal Revenue Service has provided a model notice on their website that generally will be incorporated into the plan, and that model notice will be what is provided to participants. But there are specific timelines that they must be provided that ability, that information, so that they understand and recognize that they have the right to roll over their dollars to another plan. Another notification that I forgot to mention when I talked about the joint survivor annuities for married participants is that the individuals that are looking at distributions who are married have to be provided the notification as well in regard to those joint survivor annuities and the requirement for the spousal waiver should they not choose one of the identified types of distributions from a defined benefit plan for their surviving spouse. Periodic payments, the type of distribution that's provided in regard to periodic payments are distributions that are paid at regular intervals over a specified period of time. That's the, whether it's a designated amount that they have or a designated period. You know, I want $500 for the rest of, until my account balance is zero every month, or if it's a specific as to a specified period of time, that type of, if it's over in the next 10 years or my lifetime, there's certain things that will be that will affect the actual amount of the payment. If it's over a lifetime, then the age of the annuitant is going to have a direct bearing on how long, how much that payment will be. Also, it will take into consideration if it's covering just the participant or the participant and a beneficiary or a joint life, that will affect the amount of payment. If there is on an annuity, if there is a guarantee period, or the meaning that it's a lifetime annuity with a guarantee of at least 10 years, that if they die before 10 years is up, the beneficiary will receive the remaining distribution through that 10-year period. The benefit ratio is the amount of the benefit that will then go to the surviving beneficiary, meaning sometimes it's an annuity that will be 100% distribution to the participant, but at the death of the participant, it may drop down to 50% to the beneficiary, and that will have an impact on the amount of the payment, as well as the type of mortality assumptions that are being used, the lifetime assumptions that are being used in regard to identifying what that amount of payment will be. The different types of annuities that are part of a defined benefit plan, and may be part of a defined contribution plan, but are not required to be. There's a straight life, single life annuity. What that is that it is the distribution is being made to a participant. Once the participant dies, the distribution ends. It goes nowhere else. A life annuity with guaranteed payments. That is an annuity that is paying a single amount to the participant, and they have designated that the payment is going to last for a minimum of X years, whether it be 10 years, 15 years, and if they die before that time period ends, the remaining payments that have been guaranteed would then go to the beneficiary. The conventional joint and survivor annuity is just that. It's a benefit that's being paid out over the joint lives of the participant and a survivor beneficiary. So it's whether it's it could be 100% being paid to the participant and a guaranteed under the conventional annuity of 100%, 75%, or 50% to the survivor at the death of the participant. The joint and survivor first death reduction annuity is where, regardless of if it's the participant or the survivor beneficiary, whoever dies first, the benefit would be reduced at the time of the death of whoever would pass away first. If you heard that little bark in the background, I apologize. My dog is seeing a cat outside. Hopefully that won't be a problem. And then the joint and survivor annuity with pop-up feature, that is just another form of annuity that would pop up at the death of the individual, where if it's a joint annuity, the actual benefit amount is lower because there's a joint, there's a survivor benefit, but if the beneficiary dies first, the benefit would pop up to what it would have been should it be a straight life annuity without a beneficiary, or vice versa. So there's just different forms of annuities that can be part of the defined benefit plan, and perhaps in the defined contribution plan if they're adopted. Non-periodic payments. These are withdrawals of irregular amounts at irregular times, meaning it's a partial lump sum distribution that is being made to the individual at their discretion. Installment payments that are calculated to meet required minimum distribution requirements might also be considered non-periodic payments. And then lump sum distributions are the payment of the entire benefit within a single tax year, and that's just the least tax beneficial to the individual. Generally, if someone's going to take a lump sum distribution of their full account balance in a single year, they're either rolling it somewhere else or perhaps they have a single purchase that they're trying to accomplish with that distribution. Distributions from a retirement plan before normal retirement age have specific requirements on them. From a defined benefit plan, a plan may actually prohibit that until a designated early retirement age, or they may be reduced because they are receiving a distribution before normal retirement age. They may be limited into the type of distributions that they may be able to get. From a defined contribution plan, generally they're more flexible and can occur at any age after termination of service. There's generally not any rules specifically to the types of distributions or form of distributions in a defined contribution plan just because it's occurring prior to normal retirement age. Important to note, though, however, before a certain age, before age 59 and a half, certain distributions are going to be subject to that early distribution tax penalty of 10% that occurs in some plans. In all plans except 457 plans, Section 457B governmental deferred compensation plans, but there are some exceptions to when that tax penalty applies, and I'll get into that in a minute. So distributions at termination, before early or normal retirement age, the employee may have to forfeit the employer's share of that benefit if they have not vested in the benefit plan. Meaning under a defined benefit plan, there may be vesting schedules, and if you recall, vesting schedule is just a time frame that an employer can impose as to when they will actually own the assets or own the benefit that they're being provided in that plan. In a defined contribution plan with employee contributions, employee contributions are always 100% vested and they cannot be forfeited. The only benefits that can be forfeited are those directly provided by the employer based on the vesting schedule that the employer has adopted. Prior to normal retirement age, lump sum benefits are something that can be executed, and those are going to be eligible to be rolled into another tax-favored account, IRA, or another employer plan. Often employers will also let employees, if they've left service, leave their benefits in their plan until they've reached normal retirement age or until the required minimum distribution rules apply at age 70 and a half. So employees may be allowed to leave their benefits into the plan itself until they are able to take a full benefit from the program. Distributions are taxed as ordinary income after the participant's cost basis is determined. Basically, what cost basis is the amounts that have been contributed that have already been taxed. The reason for determining the cost basis is to ensure that the individual does not experience double taxation. They're only taxed once. They're either taxing the money as it's going into the plan or they're taxing it as it's coming out of the plan. So the cost basis includes after-tax contributions, any that are made in a defined benefit plan. The employer may have the contributions to the program, 50% being employer contributions, 50% being employee after-tax contributions. That may be part of the program itself. If that's the case, if the employees are making after-tax contributions into a defined benefit plan, the actual annuity will have a cost basis that is determined that is not taxed. In a defined contribution plan, generally all of the contributions that an individual makes is going to be pre-tax unless it's being contributed into a Roth account within the plan. But that is then an after-tax contribution when it's determining cost basis. Any repayment of loans that were treated as deemed distributions are also considered into the cost basis, meaning that if an individual has taken a loan from a defined contribution plan and failed to pay back that loan and as it was identified in the terms of that agreement, and the loan itself was a deemed distribution, meaning that they were subject to tax on the outstanding loan amount, but the individual then repays that loan, That loan itself is paid back with after-tax dollars, and the loan has already been taxed, so that is part of the cost basis as well. And then any other contributions that have previously been taxed to the participant are also determined in the cost basis. So in other words, you just can't tax them twice. Regardless of the type of plan it is, there's generally a mandatory 20% withholding that will apply to taxable distributions that are eligible to be rolled into another tax-favored plan. Meaning if an individual does not roll those amounts as a direct transfer, the employer must withhold 20% federal tax withholding from those assets that are being distributed. Exceptions to that are required minimum distributions, which are required to begin at age 70. We talked about that as well. It's actually age 70 and a half. We won't get into that today, but if it's a required minimum distribution, those are not subject to the mandatory 20% withholding. Installments that are over 10 years, or if they're life annuities, installment payments, they are also not subject to the 20% withholding. If there are excess deferrals and contributions that are actually returned to the individual, those are not subject to the mandatory withholding as well. Deemed distributions for defaulted plan loans, not subject to the 20% withholding, as well as any taxable distribution that's less than $200. The early distribution tax penalty that I mentioned, the 10% penalty, applies to most distributions prior to age 15 and a half from retirement plans as well as individual retirement accounts. The exceptions to the penalty are the governmental 457B plans, early distributions from qualified plans to public safety employees over age 50. Public safety employees are police and fire. Distributions made as a result of the participant's death, disability, or qualified domestic relations order. Distributions that are made in substantially equal payments over the participant or joint lifetime of the participant are not subject to the 10% penalty as well. Required minimum distributions, those are distributions that are required to be made at the beginning for employer plans the later of April 1 following the year the participant attains age 70 and a half or retires. For individual retirement accounts, it's April 1 following the year the participant attains age 70 and a half. In employer plans, if they wait till April 1 of the year following the year they attain age 70 and a half, they must take two distributions in that first year. So they're delaying receipt of the distribution, and they're delaying the taxation on that first year's distribution for 1 year. But then the second year, they're actually taking distributions that equal 2 years' distributions under the calculation of the RMD. That applies, again, to all of the various types of plans. There are no exceptions to that unless they haven't retired yet. And then they won't have to begin that until they retire. In regard to how the RMD is processed, different types of accounts, you can't total them together, you can't aggregate them to determine the amount that must be distributed under the RMD. So it's a critical factor. They can't take everything out of their supplemental plan or out of their IRA and nothing out of their 457 or 403B plan. They've got to take the RMD for each plan type separately. It's important to understand that there is a substantial tax penalty for failing to comply with these rules. 50% of the amount that should have been distributed that wasn't is then a tax penalty on the participants. It also can jeopardize the plan's tax qualification status for failing to comply with the RMD rules. So complying is not something that is nice to do. It's absolute. It's important that in regard to an employer-sponsored plan that there are steps taken to make sure that those that are subject to the RMD rules that have reached that age and perhaps you no longer have located, you can find them, you have taken steps to locate those individuals. Prior to last year, the Internal Revenue Service would forward mail, if they had an address on file, to a participant who is subject to the RMD rules. They no longer do that. So there are locator services. There's other ways to go about trying to find them, but it's up to the employer to ensure that those individuals are, the due diligence is taken to find all those that are subject to the RMD rules. In order to calculate the amount that must be distributed under the RMD rules, a uniform lifetime table, it cannot be based on the sex of an individual, it's uniform, must be used to calculate the amount that must be distributed, and it's based on a joint life expectancy. The RMD also applies to accounts that are of, to beneficiary distributions as well. If a beneficiary has been designated for that account, it's based on the life expectancy of the beneficiary. If the individual has not identified a specific beneficiary, it may be based on the life expectancy of the participant at the time of death, or 5 years within the participant's death. So there's different ways to apply the RMD rules for beneficiaries that are identified in federal tax laws, and that the plan must follow. Rollovers are the assets that are transferred from an employer plan to another eligible employer plan or a traditional IRA. The individual participant has a right to transfer assets either as a direct or indirect rollover, and that preserves the tax-deferred status of those assets up until the RMD rules apply. So they have a right under federal tax laws to continue that tax-deferred status of those assets for as long as desired up to the RMD rules take effect. It avoids early distribution penalties should that individual take a distribution prior to age 59 and a half. And rollovers into 457 plans are specific. There's specific rules associated to those, meaning that if a plan, a 457 plan, allows rollovers into their plan from another plan type, they have to separately track those assets and apply the 59 and a half early distribution penalty on those assets that are rolled in. Assets that are rolled out of a 457 plan take on the features of the receiving plan. So if the assets are rolling into a 401k or an IRA from a 457 plan and the individual takes a distribution prior to 59 and a half from those assets, then that early distribution tax penalty would apply. Difference between a direct and indirect rollover. A direct rollover is transferred directly from one plan to another. A plan must permit direct rollovers out, but they're not required to accept rollovers into the plan. The individual does not have access to that money. It is individually, whether the plan directly makes that rollover transaction to the receiving plan, or the individual may be given a check for that rollover, but it must be made out to that receiving plan. The individual can have no access to those assets. Indirect rollover is the participant is given the money, and then they have up to 60 days to determine if they want to roll it into another plan. That distribution is subject to 20% tax withholding, so if they want to roll 100% of that distribution into the next account, they would have to come up with 20% out of pocket to make up that 100%. Eligible rollover distributions. I see that I'm running out of time, so I'm going to hurry through these a little bit, but feel free to write some questions down into the chat box if I'm going too fast or something's not clear. And then I'll try to get to them before we wrap this up. Eligible rollover distributions are any taxable portion of a distribution from a retirement account except for payments for more than 10 years or lifetime. These are distributions that are not eligible for rollover. The amount that's paid out under the RMD rules, hardship distributions and loans, as well as distributions to correct excess contributions, they are not eligible for rollover. Distributions to the spouse and non-spouse beneficiaries may be eligible for rollover, and there's specific rules associated with those distributions. There are some in-service distributions that can be allowed into the program As I mentioned earlier, they're not mandatory. The employer must adopt these in order to allow them. In-service distributions include financial hardship withdrawals, loans, de minimis distributions of small inactive account balances, and distributions upon attainment of age 59 and a half for certain defined contribution plans and 62 for defined benefit plans. So there's some differences between hardship distributions in 401k and 403b plans versus financial emergency withdrawals in 457 plans. Again, plans are not required to make these available. The amount that can be released is only the amount necessary to relieve the immediate and heavy financial need. These elective deferrals, if approved, must require that the contributions, any new contributions that are being made into the program are prohibited for a period of at least 6 months. There are specific guidelines that the Internal Revenue Service provides, safe harbor guidelines for identifying when the requirements of a financial need exist, but any distribution that's made under the hardship distribution is subject to tax, federal regular income tax as well. If it's prior to age 59 and a half, these under a 401k and 403b are subject to the early distribution tax penalty. The types of safe harbor requirements under 401k and 403b, purchase of a primary residence, first-time primary residence, some college tuition for the participant and their dependents. There's some specific rules in regard to the types of distributions that can be allowed under this provision. 457B governmental plan emergency withdrawal rules are more restrictive than the hardship distributions under 401k and 457. There are specific examples of the situations that meet the Internal Revenue Code requirements. It also can only, the amount necessary to relieve the immediate financial, heavy financial need can be released. There is no early distribution tax penalty that applies to these amounts, only the necessary, only regular income tax is associated with these distributions. In addition, there must be sufficient documentation that's maintained, that's required and maintained to demonstrate that these distributions actually meet the requirements of the federal tax law in regard to releasing dollars under the financial emergency withdrawal provision. Loans are another in-service distribution that may be allowed. Plans are not required to permit that, but if they do, they must incorporate that provision into their plan document. There's certain requirements as to minimum and the maximums that can be permitted to be loaned, and there are specific time frames as to when loans must be repaid. It's important to recognize that if they're not structured properly within the plan, the loan becomes a deemed distribution and immediately taxable to the participant. So if the plan doesn't do it right, you're subjecting the participants that have received a loan to immediate taxation on that full loan amount. If a deemed distribution occurs, that taxation is going to include, if applicable, the 10% early distribution tax penalty, meaning if it occurs prior to age 59 and a half, the individual not only is going to be subject to immediate taxation, but also the 10% tax penalty. I skipped a slide here. De minimis distributions, qualified plans can adopt a provision that would involuntarily cash out small accounts that are of terminated employees that are $5,000 or less, meaning that regardless of if the participant elects to receive them or not, the plan can automatically cash those out and send the amounts to the individual employee. If they are greater than $1,000, however, the employer must establish an individual retirement account or another retirement account that those amounts are rolled into, meaning that they can't pay it out and subject the individual to immediate taxation on the full amount. If it's $5,000, if it's more than $1,000, it's got to be rolled somewhere. In the 457 governmental plans, defined contribution plans, the de minimis distribution is a little different. The employer can actually adopt a provision that allows not only involuntary cash outs, but a cash out at the employee direction, meaning that if they have had an account balance with no deferral activity, they don't need to be terminated, but if they have had no deferral activity for 2 years or more and their account balance is under $5,000, they can request that they receive that, even though they've not terminated, they can receive the entire balance as a cash out. This also can be made as an involuntary cash out as well. But the same rollover rules apply to the 457 plan as the other types of plan, meaning that if it's over $1,000, they must roll it into another account unless the individual actually requests it differently. Qualified domestic relations order is something that's required under ERISA plans. Generally, you're going to find similar rules again in state statutes, but it provides the opportunity to divide a participant's account balance to an alternate payee as a result of a court order. Generally, it's going to be a domestic relations order that has been provided to divide the retirement account to an alternate payee, and the plan itself is going to have specific procedures for determining if that order is an actual qualified domestic relations order and how the benefits will be paid. And you're going to have that specific procedure, the specific process identified in the plan document. In general, though, the alternate payee will have the same distribution choices as that of a participant, and the spouse or former spouse that is the alternate payee may be eligible to roll over that distribution to another account as well. The alternate payee, however, is going to be liable for the taxes on that distribution. The 10% early distribution penalty, however, will not apply. Okay, so I think I was able to get through that so we have some time for questions. Just as a reminder, in December, our third and final webinar for this course is going to cover administration issues in regard to plan amendments and special events. We'll also cover operations of a non-qualified deferred compensation plan, and then we'll wrap it up with the steps to monitor and evaluate and the importance of monitoring and evaluating retirement plans. So with that, I'm going to open it up to some questions. I see we already have one from Matthew Davis. It's due to the steep penalty for not complying with RMD requirements. Our organization forces out RMDs unless we have a signed opt-out from the participant. The opt-out form certifies the participant is still actively employed and not required to take the RMD. Is this policy becoming more common, or do most employers still place the onus for taking the RMD on the participant? Well, Matthew, I have not heard anybody else that requires an opt-out form such as that for the required minimum distribution rules, because most plans, I would think, would know if they're still actively employed or not based on the employee. I mean, it's not actively employed anywhere. It's actively employed within that retirement system. So, I've not heard of anybody having similar requirements. If you want to, anybody have any comment on that, or Matthew, if you want to ask anything different, if you want to raise your hand, I can unmute you. Oh, Matthew, okay, you responded. You have over 600 employers. So is a state system perhaps, or some employer that some retirement system that has multiple employers? Again, from my familiarity is with Wisconsin retirement system, and with the Wisconsin retirement system, they are required to send a report to the South Carolina. We have all the employers are required to send a termination report to the state retirement system when an employee retires or terminates. So that's again, it's something that is known and identified through employer reporting. But I have never heard of anybody requiring a sign-up form on required minimum distribution such as you identified. Sorry, I can't be more helpful there. Anybody else have any questions, or Matthew, do you have anything else you want to say on that? Like I said, I'd be happy to unmute you if you have anything that you want to say besides just writing by raising your hand in the attendance box. So any other questions or comments? Yeah. Okay, Matthew, you're fine. That's all set. You're all set. So I'm not seeing any other questions. I appreciate your time. And I look forward to being with you again next month when we finalize this course and go through the last chapters of the course material. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and end our session. And have a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you.